Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for August 6, 2017. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
All right, exciting show tonight. We've got a lot of great topics, and at 7:20, we're going to have back on for the second time Jackson Darr of Red Racing Horses, a conservative-leaning blog that likes to cover politics kind of from a horse race perspective. And, of course, they made a lot of news, probably their biggest news week in recent history. They commissioned a poll on the Alabama special election, and they just got released on Friday. Jackson's going to come on and discuss that, in addition to some other critical races coming up after that in 2018. So we're looking forward to that. But until then, we really lost some show content on Monday, guys. Anthony Scaramucci, I can only imagine all of the good discussions we could have had over what he would have done in his communication advisor role, and he's out. Tim, how torn up are you about this?
Oh, I'm crushed. I'm sure I'm not as crushed as the late night comics are, especially those on HBO that can repeat word for word what he said. But isn't it interesting? The communications director got in trouble for communicating. Boy, did he ever! There's talk that Ivanka, in particular, did not like what he was doing and wanted him out. And is it possible that that interview with New Yorker didn't even rise to Donald Trump's standards? I mean, was it too lowball even for Donald Trump? Let me lay that thought on y'all and y'all respond to that one.
Yeah, Catherine, Ivanka Trump got offended. A lot of the things he said I could see being offensive to women. And then the fact the way he treated his wife and when she was going to give birth at any moment and then did end up giving birth. What is your take on this?
Oh, well, good riddance to bad rubbish, I mean, I agree that he would have, provided us with a lot of fodder for discussion and chuckles, but it's best that he's gone.
Yes.
I think that on an ordinary day that it wouldn't have offended Donald Trump, but I think he recognized the political capital that was being wasted by having him there, and that's why one of the reasons he's gone. But I don't think I wouldn't have been surprised if it didn't offend him. It just offended his, ability to be popular.
Yeah, and Sybil said that he's getting a lot of attention Donald Trump wanted. I know that one of the early narratives, too, was General Kelly comes in, new chief of staff. He takes the job on Monday. He organizes his paper clips over the weekend. And Monday morning, the first action, Anthony Scaramucci's out, and you think, man, this guy's going to take charge. You think, this guy looks like an adult because, of course, the talk over the weekend was, can anybody tame Donald Trump? And you see the first move, and I'll admit it, I was a little bit impressed. But then as the week drags on, you see that General Kelly, he can probably command thousands of troops a lot of times because they follow. But Donald Trump, during the week, made up two phone calls, called the White House a dump, and called the state of New Hampshire a drug den four completely out of control either statements or actions, because I guess fabricating calls, I might say, is more of an action than a statement. An English, you know, professor might could get into if that's right or wrong. Tim, how did this kind of blow up on General Kelly, or did he expect this and know that he can't control Donald Trump?
Well, if he didn't know it, he certainly knows it now. General Kelly can do a lot of things. He can organize the West Wing. He can get it running a little smoother. He can do a lot of stuff, but one thing that no one has ever been able to do is to control Donald Trump, what he says, what he does. Whether General Kelly or anyone else likes it or not, this administration is going to be viewed first and foremost by how the President of the United States, who is the person at the top, how he conducts himself. And as long as Donald Trump continues to tweet and mouth and hold raucous rallies and this and that and the other, the White House is still going to be viewed in the same light, whether it's falling apart or whether it's running pretty good that day. Wouldn't you agree, Catherine?
Yeah, I mean, I think Kelly's going to, you know, try to command the staff, and, you know, but he can't control Donald Trump. And that's why people mm-hmm. like Donald Trump. You know, I mean, that's his part of his popularity, is that, you know, he can't be silenced. I mean, this White House being a dump thing, it's just a prophecy at this point. He's going to make it, he's already making it a dump, you know, from the West Wing, so he's just, you know, fulfilling his statement now.
Yeah, Catherine, I was trying to say is, I think you're right about the fact that there's a tell-it-like-it-is quality that some of his supporters like, but that is when a statement is something, even if the majority of Americans don't agree with it, if the majority of his supporters agree with it, but I don't know if some of these statements, even they can get behind. You know, I don't know many Americans that would ever believe that the White House, the crown jewel of the American penal system, as it was once called, is a dump. I don't think the average American has a negative view of the state of New Hampshire. And then, of course, just making up calls, that's a whole other matter altogether. Let's kind of get into these statements. Where do y'all think, and Catherine, I'll give you this one first, where do you think this hurts him? Because I can't imagine that it helps him. Calling the White House the home of America's leader, one of the most famous buildings in the world, certainly in our country, calling it a dump, what does that do to him politically?
I don't think it has much impact politically. I think it's just a illustration of his delight with, you know, all things ornate and obvious. He's not a stately guy. He's not like, he wants everything in gold and you know, what people might call fancy, whereas the White House is a more stately and a more traditional building, and it's just not his style, so it's a dump to him. I mean, look at his apartment at Trump Tower. It's awful. It's ugly, but it's his style.
Well, I mean, obviously there are different ones that have different tastes. I mean, like one of us might say, I don't really like log cabins, but we could go to a super nice, you know, cabin in the woods and appreciate that it was well done. Tim, let me kind of frame it this way. This is where I do think it can hurt him. If one of us is having a of debate, if you will, or talking about Donald Trump. We have somebody that, you know, voted for him, likes some of his policy positions, and we say, the guy's just out of touch. He's just not one of us. And they go, this is something we can clearly point to. Hey, the White House is a lot nicer than your house, my house, and every house on our block. You know, all of us would love to live in a house that nice. There's no way we would begin to call it a dump. And I think almost every single person any of us talk to would agree with that. Do you see that's the kind of thing that could hurt him and just one of those just gives ammunition to the other side that everybody can agree with?
Well, I actually agree with both of you. I agree with Catherine that politically it probably won't do anything but harden the positions of both sides. It seems that his core of people are just choosing at this point to ignore any negative thing about him, and there's plenty of it out there, and they're going along with him anyway. I don't think this hurts him with that group. But people who are moderates, are moderate-leaning Republicans, those type of people, it just reinforces their positions that there's no way they can come to him or come back to him. I do agree with you that, once again, this goes to show how totally out of touch this guy is with the average person and even those people I was talking about who just voted for him. A lot of us have toured the White House. I was literally blown away by the place. There's 132 rooms. I mean, there's like 35 bathrooms or something in that place. And to me, it was just
gorgeous
place. It's just a gorgeous place. And I know that he has like this three-story penthouse on the top of some of the highest-priced real estate in the country, and there's gold fixtures everywhere there, and there's these giant marble columns. There's full-size paintings of Greek mythological pictures positioned right next to the full-size pictures of him, which he loves looking at. There's that famous picture, you know, of him and his wife and his kid with the stuffed lion, and just, I mean, it just looks like something from a fabulous Hollywood movie set or something. But to call the White House, the true people's house, a dump, I mean, come on. They have a budget of $1.6 million just to fix up the place every year. They don't let it fall apart. It's a beautiful place. It's an imposing place. It's probably the biggest home court advantage the Oval Office is anywhere in the world. I mean, come on, to say these things about it. But again, his supporters, nah, I don't think that gets rid of them, David. Sorry, can't go with you there.
Well, like I said, I think it gives something that people can bring up when they talk to somebody. And it's not something that you have to know you're going to have to debate 50-50 on because, say, a policy difference. Well, let's get to another one of these statements. And this, I guess, gets more acute. The state of New Hampshire, I've never been. Have either of y'all been to New Hampshire?
No.
I've been to New Hampshire. I have several times.
Okay. Nice place or drug den?
Yeah.
Nice place?
It's a very nice,
okay,
place.
Nice place. Well, what I've heard about New Hampshire, it has a lot of nice things about it, in New Hampshire. I mean, and here's the thing. If you're president of the United States, I mean, obviously in Georgia, we love to make Alabama jokes. But we would not expect the president of the United States to start making jokes about Alabama because they're the president of all the states. Just call the state a drug den. Now, this I don't think will move a Wyoming or a Mississippi Trump supporter, but in the still somewhat battleground state of New Hampshire, the biggest battleground state in the New England area, I can't imagine this helps. Catherine?
I don't think it helps. I mean, let's just be honest, though, that New Hampshire does have an opioid problem, a significant opioid problem, and I think what he was trying, I mean, it didn't make sense, but I don't think you can blame Mexico for the opioid problem in the United States, because that's not, it's not, you know, OxyContin does not come from Mexico.
unfortunately, sure, man, I've actually heard at the police have come into a school before. It's things like Sudafed, Drano, not products that we associate with Mexico, like maybe avocados.
But anyway,
so, yeah, I agree that was off base.
In any event, it was a stupid thing to say. And, yes, I mean, I think that does, you know, limit his appeal to New Hampshire voters. They will, you know, when you're, whatever state you live in, you have some, you know, loyalty to that state. And you remember when someone says something awful about your state when you're, you know, at the ballot box. And it'll be used forever in New Hampshire. Yeah, everybody will be like, oh, yeah, Trump, he's the one who called us a drug den. I mean, oh, that'll live on for decades, right? Don't you think?
Yeah.
It was a stupid thing to say.
Tim, we have, of course, opioid crisis seemingly in every state has some. Unfortunately,
yeah.
I think some places may be more percentage-wise than others. How much will this hurt him in New Hampshire?
Well, it's not going to help him at all. You know what? The way Trump thinks, I bet he would not have said that if he had carried the state of New Hampshire. You notice he didn't say that about, say, Ohio, which has perhaps the worst opioid problem of any state in the country, or at least according to their governor, it's just runaway there. He didn't say that about them because he won Ohio. That's the way Donald Trump would think. You know that? He really
but
would.
He
would
that,
think that way.
But he did say that he won New Hampshire, which he didn't. In the same statement, right? He called it a – he did. He called it a whatever, a drug den, and then he said he won it, which he didn't.
Yeah,
I mean,
well,
he just
didn't.
Can like he can lie and lie and lie all day, and nobody seems to check him on it.
Don't worry about Mexico. Our president's already taken care of them. All you got to do is make a call that never happens, and Mexico is fixed, right? Jeez.
Oh, yeah. Now, we haven't even got into the fake calls, but I love how he does this. He finds some, you know, I really want it because you exclude this. I mean, I guess he could go to California and say, you know, if you exclude all the people that live within 100 miles of the Pacific Ocean, I don't know, he might have won California. But whatever. You know, if the other team gets 450 points in the first half, so-and-so team might have won instead of getting blown out 70-0. I mean, that's just nonsense, and I ought to wear thin on people. But as you see in polls, what, over half his supporters believe he won the popular vote and lost by 3 million. So I guess he'll delude them into thinking that he won Vermont, Hawaii, and California all by the end of it, which is crazy.
The popular
now,
vote,
look,
all that, yeah.
Yeah, we don't have much time on this one, but these fake calls, and I cringe every time I hear the term fake news because obviously it's just now news you don't agree with. You know, it is what it is. But these are calls that he just completely making out of thin air because the Mexican president and the Boy Scout leaders both say no such call existed. Let's get into the Mexico one since it has much more policy implications. Catherine, why would he do this? How could he think he could do this?
I don't understand if you can. I mean, I really don't have any explanation for it, except that you know, what did Sarah, is that her name?
Sarah Huckabee.
Name?
Sanders.
Yeah, Sarah
Sanders,
Huckabee.
Maybe.
I can never remember her name. She
what's my
said
thought?
That it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I know who she is. I just can't remember her name. I'm old. I don't remember things sometimes. but she said that, he misspoke, but it was a conversation he had at the G20. Okay, what? Like, and the same thing about the Boy Scout call. She said that, those were personal conversations that he had, not phone calls. Well, then why did he call him phone call? Like, is he so Donald that he doesn't even know whether he had a personal face-to-face conversation or a phone call? Like, how does that happen? I don't understand it.
Tim, we're lucky he didn't say that he had the call with the Boy Scouts. It really happened when he was buying Girl Scout cookies from a Girl Scout. What in the world's going on here?
Oh, boy, how many ways can we look at this? First of all, these people that get out and double down for him, like Huckabee's daughter, like Kellyanne Conway, those people that will go on, and they'll actually back him up on this stuff. He says he likes those sort of people. He really does. He likes to keep them around him because they go right down the line with the boss. There's a lot of people that think Donald Trump is not dumb. Donald Trump is very intelligent, and he is playing the media so hard as just to put out all this disinformation and make everything so irrelevant that people don't know what's real and what's not. And then there's the people like me that wonder if his mind is right, to be honest with you. And I hate to say that, but I wonder if that poor man's mind's right.
Well, I would make a comment on that, but we've got our guest on the line, and I want to get to him. For the second time on the Kudzu Vine, member of the Red Racing Horses blog, welcome back, Jackson Dar. Welcome, Jackson.
Well, hello, y'all.
Yeah, good to have you on. Now, first off, we were planning to talk a lot about Senate races, and then I was texting you right before the show, and you said you were even ready to discuss dog catcher races. Tim's dog
is a famous person
on Facebook. My dog's heard about it. We got to know who's the worst candidate for dog catcher because they, of course, they want to vote for the worst. They want to be incompetent. So,
well, as you know, the worst candidate for dog catcher has got to be, you know, whoever runs the local shelter, because he's just going to, you know, use the government to move all that business to him. You know, I mean, so I mean, it's going to be a racket, is what it's going to be.
Maybe so. Well, seriously, I just couldn't resist that one. When you were texting me that, I looked down and saw my dogs on the porch and thought, oh, my goodness. Well, let's get into some real stuff. Y'all did a poll, and y'all took up money and donations and gave special access. Great work on that Alabama poll, special election for U.S. Senate. And it really, the findings to me were commensurate with the other public poll that was published a few days earlier. But the two leading candidates were flipped, but the numbers were so close it made it look like both polls were pretty sound numbers. Tell us about what y'all found.
Well, you know, your point out it is similar, and it is similar, but what's interesting is, okay, so it's in the plus or minus 5 points margin of error, right? By the way, Brooks is outside that margin of error, so he's definitely in third. That's one thing. Second thing is, it was pretty similar, so really either one could be leading slightly. But what's really interesting is we also polled the runoff, unlike everybody else. And we found that once you go to the runoff, you get slightly higher numbers for both candidates, but still a 2-point spread and still in Moore's favor.
Mm.
But it's still really low.
Yeah.
It still only goes up a few points. It's about 34, 32 for the runoff. So what that means is there's a large number of voters right now who are really fence-sitting, especially if they're going for other candidates. A lot of Brooks' voters, on the one hand, a lot of them don't really like Roy Moore. A lot of Brooks' voters tend to be a bit more upscale. He polls better in the north, but he also polls better around Birmingham, right? But you know, Moore's voters are much more rural. And Tripp Pittman, who's in, I believe, fourth place, you know, he's got a decent number of voters, but very concentrated down in the Mobile area, kind of the same to Brooks. If Brooks and Pittman were the same guy, then they, you know, he'd only be a few points behind in third, I think. He might even be within margin of error. But because they're split, you know, neither of them is going to make it to the runoff. So the question is, where do those voters go? They're more inclined to go with Strange for the most part. But remember that some of those people are going for them for regional reasons. So there might be some Huntsville people that, you know, they really like Brooks because he's from their area, but they'd rather go for Moore in a runoff with Strange. Because remember, Strange is a creature of Montgomery. So it's a really complicated picture.
Yeah.
And what it says is that there's no automatic winner. Everything's up in the air right now. And those attack ads that have been airing against Brooks are going to put the Pittman and Brooks voters in a weird position, because on the one hand, you know, that's the group that's likely to have more Never Trumpers in it, or at least people who don't like Trump that much. They're attacking Brooks for being Never Trump and all that kind of stuff. And the idea is to basically scare those voters into scare up some more support from Moore's natural support to go with Strange, make sure Strange gets into the runoff, and then look at the Brooks and Pittman voters and go, would you rather have Roy Moore, or will you bite your lip and vote for Strange even though he attacked your guy? That's the McConnell strategy.
Yeah, well, and I will tell you, I saw the y'all's congressional district breakdowns. That was excellent. I did want to ask you a question about, since Luther Strange is, I guess, the de facto incumbent, he was appointed to the seat, but he has won statewide
the
attorney general. Yes, well, I mean, but he didn't win it on his own term. That's kind of, I guess, where I'm going there. And but then, could this be part of his struggles? Could it be due to the fact that he was appointed by Robert Bentley, and there's backlash against Robert Bentley?
You know, early on when they were looking at who to appoint, there was a lot of that swirling. There was a lot of, oh, is it corrupt? Is someone paying off somebody? You know, but all that has kind of faded ever since Strange is up there. So there's probably a little bit. I'd guess that there are some voters that are piling that on as an extra reason, maybe even a few of them. But remember, that story's been out of the headlines long enough now. Voters have very short memories, but only a few people are going to remember. That may be the motivation for some of Brooks's support around Birmingham. That's the best I can think of. Some of them, you know, that's not his natural area. And some of them might say, hey, they're high-information voters. They tend to be middle-class, upper-middle-class, wealthy Republican voters around there. And they may say, oh, that was a corrupt deal. I don't want that. That was with Bentley. But most of the voters in the rest of the state aren't going to be thinking about that.
Okay. Well, I'm going to pass that over to Catherine, then Tim. Catherine and Tim, you can continue to ask about Alabama, but feel free to shift to some of the other races. Catherine?
I'm going to let Tim go first. Go ahead, Tim.
Well, good evening, sir, and thank you for being on with us again.
Thank you, sir.
Now, in your Alabama poll right now, only 11% of the vote is undecided. But when you do a trial heat for the runoff, say, between Moore and Strange, that number explodes to 35%. Is why is that? Is it because that the numbers are more hardened right now leading up to the first round of voting, whereas they'd be more fluid after? Or
well, I would say that. Well, because you got two factors there that are hardening the votes. A lot of these people really are waiting and seeing. They think their guy's going to get through. Remember, Brooks and Pittman have very geographically concentrated bases of support. As I said, Brooks is in around Huntsville and in Birmingham suburbs. And Pittman's, while relatively small, is extremely concentrated, especially in across in Mobile and across from there, you know, Bay Minette, Fairhope, Fort Morgan, that whole area. I've been down to that area. They have very much their own sort of circle, bubble identity, and it's really intense down there. And then with Strange, he's just the incumbent, so they're not going to, if they're just voting for him and they already like him, not going to change much. And as we all know, Moore's supporters are a little intense.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's just sort of locked into their position. The only people I think might automatically to one or the other, you know, maybe a couple of Pittman supporters would automatically jump to Strange. And then, of course, Brinson, who's way back in the back with just a few percentage points, but he, remember, is also a big religious conservative. And his people would automatically search, even though it's only a few percentage points.
Mm-hmm.
I would be very surprised if they didn't immediately go to Moore. So that's probably where his few bump-up percentages are going. It's just 3 or 4% of the vote, probably.
Oh, I see. Okay. I am going to switch gears and ask one more question, but I'm going in a completely different direction, and I'll throw it back to Catherine. Nationally, many pundits on, you know, every political persuasion you can think of
They are looking ahead to the midterms next year, and they are saying that the real horse race, the real battlefield, is for control of the U.S. House of Representatives. Now, we know the numbers that the Democrats at present would need like 24 seats to win control of the House. In your early looks at next year's congressional races, would you say or think that there are enough competitive seats out there for them to accomplish that?
Number of competitive seats, yes. Number of competitive candidates at this point, no.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's enough. There's definitely enough seats out there. I mean, you know, there's several dozen that are worth, you know, they're able to take, especially if you get some kind of wave behind you. We'll have to see about that. On the one hand, mm-hmm. president's numbers are low. On the other hand, the economy's fairly strong. We can argue mm-hmm. about, you know, who did that, but the point is that it is. It's, mm-hmm. you know, there's factors pointing each way. I think to start out with a small advantage, but you got to look at individual races. Now, in some right. races, y'all are doing really well. Like there was just a big, I don't know how winnable the race is because it's an R+9 seat. But you know, Amy McGrath in Kentucky, I'm sure you saw her in
right.
some video that kind of went all over everywhere. She raised
yes.
all that money. That's a good recruit. Now it's in kind of an outer fringe of the winnability on districts, but. But it's still a good recruit, right?
Uh-huh.
You know, you guys are probably going to have really good recruits in California. You usually do
mm-hmm.
because there's a lot of Democrats out there. Some will even move in from out of the district and still be pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, Doug Applegate will probably run again, you know,
mm-hmm.
out in California 49. But there's some districts where, frankly, there's been a lot of struggle. Like, for instance,
mm-hmm.
two of the districts that you would normally put on there as ones that are just, you need to win these to get over the top, or you have to somehow expand the map, is Pennsylvania 6 and Pennsylvania 7. They're
mm-hmm.
joining districts in the Philadelphia suburbs.
Right.
Now, you guys have had a lot of candidates file there. Don't get me wrong. Several per race. But most of the candidates live in Philadelphia, which isn't even in the district. And, you know, isn't in either in any form. And there are no local Democrats that have filed. There's one really strong guy who could probably make one a race almost immediately. That's State Senator Andy Dinneman. But he's not running as
uh-huh.
of now. And
uh-huh.
you know, a lot of the ones who were coming out from Philly to the suburbs, you know, they're hardcore progressives in districts that don't like Trump, but also really like their local moderate Republican, Pat Meehan, Costello, you know. Whether you think they're moderate or not, they have moderate images. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, so those are problems. On the other hand, there's some districts that are, you know, looking really well for you guys. I was just looking at, you know, Florida. You know, you're almost certainly going to flip Florida 27, Ileana
mm-hmm.
Leighton's old seat. So there's a nice
mm-hmm.
win for y'all, and you're probably going to hold on to the 7th up in Orlando.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to do well for y'all. But on the other hand,
mm-hmm.
some of the upstate New York districts, the recruitment just hasn't been there.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and
we can go back and forth,
let me,
but that's pretty much how it
turns out. Let me segue off of that right quick. How has Republican recruitment been going for some of the same toss-up type districts?
You're talking about for districts we might take?
Yes.
Well, some of it's been going all right. There's been several recruited to run up against Tom O'Halloran
uh-huh.
In Arizona, but who knows, because there's a lot of moving parts in Arizona in a minute. We'll get to that in a second.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you know, we just pulled Danny Tarkanian is thinking about running again for Nevada
again.
3.
Wow.
And you know, it's a district that voted for Trump by a point, and, you know, but y'all hold it, and, you know, because Jackie Rosen's probably running for Senate or for governor. I can't remember which right now. But anyway, the point
mm-hmm.
is that we might have trouble, even though it was a district Trump won by a point. I mean, our recruiting has probably been a little bit worse than yours, but on the one hand, we've got more incumbents in these top
right.
districts. So
right.
your recruiting has been a little bit better, but if you're the out party, your recruiting has to be way better.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
It's easier to get a Democrat to run right now. They feel like they've got the wind at their backs. They feel like they're running up against the Trump administration and they can't lose. Well, if you can only – and y'all get more good recruits, don't get me wrong. We just need to see what the number ends up being and which races. Because if y'all have a great recruit in rural Mississippi, it's not going to do you very well. You know, it's not going to do much good.
Right.
So that I can't say for sure right now, but the clip is decent, you know. But I would say slightly behind the curve.
Slightly behind the curve. All right, I appreciate it. Thank you for that excellent analysis. Catherine?
Thanks so much for being on with us tonight. We really appreciate it and really appreciate all the hard work you guys do at your site, all the polls and stuff. It's very interesting the way you compile it all. Very helpful.
We're all we don't do any of this for money. We're all volunteers too. So
yeah, I read one of the posts about gerrymandering. It was very interesting. I don't necessarily agree with all, but we're not going to talk about that. I just mentioned it.
Sure.
It was very extensive. I just wondered what you thought are the most interesting Senate races coming up. Like, which ones are you most intrigued by? I mean, we talk about all of them, but aside from the Alabama, I'm talking about the 2018 Senate races.
Well, you know, the ones that have really been in the news are Arizona and Michigan, of course. Now,
right.
I'm also really interested in Indiana, and I'm also really interested in I'm a little bit interested in Pennsylvania, but only just a little bit, and only recently.
Well, let's talk about Michigan. That's my home state.
Okay.
So, is Kid Rock going to run?
I have no earthly clue. You know, actually, one of our users is a local party chairman of a pretty big, very Republican county, and he doesn't know, so we'll be the first to know. We're pretty close to it. But, from what I have heard, the consideration is serious and not a joke and not a record stunt. On the other hand, and, you know, we had dueling polls the other day. Who knows which one's right? But on the other hand, if he were to run, it's pretty attractive because T would immediately win the primary, no question. All the polls agree on that. So
he
wouldn't have to fight through a primary.
Well, that's good, but I mean, would we all? if he did run, his candidacy would be taken seriously, is what you're saying.
Yes. Well, because A, he would immediately clear the field in the primary. Everyone else would, if they were smart, would drop out. B, he has enough money to where he could immediately hire consultants. He doesn't have the problem that a lot of candidates do where they need to spend a lot of lead-up time raising money. He'll need to raise some money. He's not just going to use his own. But he can immediately get people on board that will make sure he has the money to run. So and immediately have, consulting, all that kind of fun stuff. Now, of course, someone's going to need to trail behind him and make sure the vampires don't leech on. But,
Oh, we know about that here in Georgia, don't we?
I'm sure you do. On both sides of the aisle.
Oh, yeah. It's something that we talk about quite frequently on Cut Divine.
They take different tacks. The Republicans usually come straight at you and promise you the moon. The Democrats try to disguise it as a nonprofit.
I don't know.
Can I jump in a little bit of follow-up question here, and then Catherine, you jump back in. You said polls show that it wins the primary. The one I've seen is the Delphi Analytica poll, and it had so many undecideds, and it had no track record that it was kind of like, I don't know what this poll means. Have you seen other ones besides the Delphi Analytica one that came out about a month ago?
Sure. The Trafalgar one. The Trafalgar one showed him at 49.8% in the primary.
Wow.
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah, that one got past us. I see we're probably reading Red Racing Horses 6 days a week, and we need to start clicking on it 7 because we missed it.
Okay, well, I knew that question wouldn't have made sense out of order.
No, go ahead, David.
Okay. I just knew that question, I didn't want to ask it after we had started into three other states. Well, let me ask you about one of the states, Arizona. People thought it would be close last time, and I think if the presidential race would have been a little more evenly distributed, it was close, obviously, but around the country it might have even been closer. But Jeff Flake, his popularity, according to public policy polling, is 18 approve, and this, I believe, is in the Republican Party, and 63 disapprove. Actually, that is overall. But his Republican approval rating is 22%. It shows him losing in a primary, and it shows him losing in a general. How did Jeff Flake become so unpopular?
Well, you got to understand that Jeff Flake is a very specific type of person. Jeff Flake is very conservative, but he's also very, very Mormon. And it's not because he's Mormon, necessarily. People don't hate him because of his religion. But because he has such, how would I put it, such firm stands in a very specific worldview, that he keeps to it. And this is, you know, we don't need to get into the long thing, but this is kind of a problem with, you know, politics of any kind, modern ancient, whatever you go into. You know, if you take a very specific kind of stance, you tend to piss off 80% of the electorate. And Jeff Flake really, really, really feels that that illegal immigrants should be given a path to citizenship, and really, really, really feels that whatever gets you there is the important part, because he's a religious man and he feels that he cares for everyone and wants to be as nice and compassionate to everyone as he can. And that really pisses off Republican primary voters, especially in Arizona. On the other hand, he's very fiscally conservative. Doesn't approve of, you know, large amount, more than a normal safety net for welfare. You know, is against Obamacare, all these other things that, you know, piss off Democrats and stop him from that, from getting a lot of crossover appeal through that. So the Democrats already hated him because they knew he was very conservative and took a very conservative line in the House. So they already disliked him. And then he pissed off the Republicans when he said, hey, I just got to the U.S. Senate from Arizona, a very, you know, anti-illegal immigrant state, and I want path to citizenship and I want them to stay. And there you go. You've already pissed off 40% of the state. You just pissed off another 40%.
Yeah, we're talking about it. He kind of won't, you know, stay there at all and stay across. I just picture Homer Simpson going, stupid Flake guy with treat others as you want to be treated. I mean, it just blows my mind that somehow that would become
sure,
popular.
But
he's suffering
for keeping to the principles of his religion. That is what he is suffering for keep. I mean, I don't even necessarily agree with him. I'm not giving a stance one way or the other. But he is a prisoner of conscience of his own stupidity. But it's prisoner of conscience.
No, our principles. I don't know that would always be considered stupidity, and I don't want us to have a theological podcast. Either. Let's talk about another candidate that's running against him, Kelly Ward, state senator. She ran against John McCain. She's looking like she's going to run against Jeff Flake. I don't know if she's announced, but, you know, she's doing the tours and all what have you, and listed as a candidate. When John McCain was announced he had brain cancer, she came out that weekend and said, you know, he should drop out or resign his Senate seat for the good of Arizonans so they can have full representation. And she was roundly criticized in a lot of quarters, and not that anybody's taking that back, but then John McCain shows that he can still go to the Senate, but he voted against the Republican Party, sans Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins, on the health care bill. And so now in the Republican primary, does that statement of Kelly Ward become popular, or is it still tacky because it goes back to the fact that he has brain cancer?
I think it's still mostly considered tacky. Now, here's the thing. I was wondering when we get to McCain's seat. He's most likely not going to be running again. I mean, this is inoperable, 100% fatality, terminal brain cancer. He is not going to make it another, you know, year and a half and then six more. He's just not. So if he were running for reelection, you know, someone should put him somewhere for, you know, mental incompetence or something at that point. I mean, I don't think he's going to do that. but because the cancer would have got to his brain at that point, because he's not going to last another 7.5 years. Statistically, it just doesn't happen unless you're about 1%. So, I mean, this is what Ted Kennedy had. You can't get rid of it. So, I mean, the problem is she's not going to be facing McCain in the primary. It might allow her to beat McCain in the primary, but she won't be facing him. And she has a ceiling of support. I mean, there's a nickname for her in Republican circles, and I can say it because I'm never going to work for her. Call her Chemtrails Kelly. I mean, she's a little bit off. Okay. And I can say that because I wouldn't work for her if she paid me $20,000 a month. So, you know, she's a little bit out there. You know, she's out there with the don't fluoridate the water people. And, you know, not making it a left or right thing, just making it a crazy or not crazy thing. You know, a lot of left-wing people get into that stuff, too. When you get out to the edges, everything starts to look similar. And, you know, so, I mean, she's got a ceiling of her support. Now, Arizona happens to have an unusually high amount of that. But remember, a lot of her percentage last time was people being fed up with McCain. If McCain's gone, she's going to drop to, I ballpark it, no more than 30% of the vote in the primary.
Yeah. Well, and one thing that do keep in mind, I mean, he did win re-election last cycle. His term runs through 2022. I don't want to, once again, have a medical discussion, and I don't want to be tacky doing a death watch on him. So, I mean, it's not like his true term comes up that soon.
You may not
Kelly
want to
Ward,
do it, but that's what they're doing.
Well, I mean, someone will, but I don't have to because I don't live in Arizona. Although I will tell Kelly Ward, if you're listening, I will not work your campaign, but I will mow your lawn or clean your pool for $20 or $20,000 a month. What did you say, $20,000 a month? I'll take that for some around the house task that doesn't compromise my political principles. Well, one final race that I think we can get to, and seen as one of the
If we can stay on Arizona for just a second. Stay on Arizona for just a second, because I have good news for you. Good news for you guys. That good news is, if I don't know if you've noticed, but Kyrsten Sinema is considering jumping into one of the races.
Ooh.
Now, Kyrsten Sinema started out as somebody we thought we really wanted to face a few years ago. You know, she kind of looks like a hipster. She's just kind of out there, but she hasn't voted that way. Now, I don't know whether that's her true opinion or whether she's hedging her bets or whatever it is, but either way, it's allowed her to build a very different image from the one she came in with. And she is the one and only candidate in Arizona that I wouldn't ever want to face. She's not an automatic lock for anything, but she is very, very strong. Now, she's considering running for Senate. Now, a lot of people think that's Jeff Flake, and the reason I bring up the Death Watch kind of stuff is that she'd probably more likely want to go after an open seat. And so she's probably going to look like she's running against Jeff Flake, but really she's probably banking on getting into an open seat race. Because even though Flake looks like he'd lose the general, you can never count out an incumbent, you know, until right up near the end. And so,
yeah. Although those approval ratings are pretty just, although I wonder if you would face him, you could face him, it knocks him off. Well, let's move over to another race just to the north in Nevada. His name escapes me, and I've clicked on the Arizona page on Politics One. Heller, Dean Heller. He is seen to be in some trouble. Obviously, Nevada is a swing state, maybe even slightly blue. It depends on what year you're running in. And he appears to be in some trouble. And at first, he wasn't going to vote for the Republican health care plan. Then he changed back and voted for it, even the skinny repeal. What are his electoral chances?
They're better than Flake's. I mean, right now, you held the election tomorrow. You know, Flake probably loses narrowly as long as there was normal turnout. Heller is a little bit different. Heller, you have to give him a decent shot because he's from the northern part of the state, and while that's the less populous part, they tend to block vote when it's one of their own that's up. You know, you'll see that district that, you know, that's one fourth of the state that contains northern Nevada. Well, you say, oh, that's just one-fourth of the state, and that only voted, you know, low 50s or, you know, mid-50s for Trump or something. You say, yeah, but look how much it voted for Dean Heller, and you look at it, it's like, oh, 65%, you know, 70%. I mean, because Las Vegas dominates so much of the state, regionalism really becomes a factor. I mean, if he, his numbers completely fall off in the Las Vegas area, sure, he'll lose. But even if he just loses it by you know, not catastrophic numbers, the rest of the state will save him due to block voting. Think of it like the primaries in Philadelphia, where somehow the machine always wins because the Polish neighborhood comes in right at the end. That way.
Yes. Well, we're going to continue to be reading red racing horses. And
it's now
have to look
now
up
RH
that
elections.
Michigan RH elections. I think I put it, you can even
RH
also get it against RRH elections. Yes, well, rhelections.com, because I want to find that Michigan poll that sounds like it was just a little more accurate in its numbers. But, Jackson, we sure do thank you for coming on with all that knowledge.
Thank you very much. Anything else you need, just ask.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Have a nice day, y'all.
Yes.
Bye.
Again, Jackson Dar, if you want the horse race, electoral political side from a Republican perspective, you're not going to find better than Jackson Dar and his blog in general, because I know it's a group blog, but he's obviously one of the key people in it. Well, we've got time for about one more topic, and hopefully I won't be struck by lightning if you can hear the thunderstorm in the back. But bringing some much-needed rain. Yeah, I'm in the garage trying to get us better reception so Catherine doesn't have to yell, David, we can't hear you. I do want to come out one piece. But let's talk about what happened in West Virginia. And I don't mean the Trump rally. If y'all want to talk about it, that's fine. But the governor there, Jim Jeffries, one of the more conservative Democratic politicians, and we know that in West Virginia, it was always a Democratic stronghold, but has gone very Republican. You have to be a little right of the traditional Democratic Party seemingly to win. But I guess you thought, well, if Jim Jeffries won office as a Democrat, why would he switch? Particularly when the Republican brand is definitely not on the upswing. I was really surprised by this. Tim, how surprised were you?
Not at all. This guy was a Republican and an independent before he switched parties, I believe, 2 years ago, specifically to run for governor, because I think he looked at the lay of the land and thought that running as a Democrat provided him an easier path to the general election. As it turns out, it did just that. A lot of people thought it was a great idea. Oh, we can have a Democrat that represents the conservative values of Virginia. I mean, I wonder what they think now. I don't like party switchers, however they switch. They can't be trusted. For instance, I bet if Clinton was president, he wouldn't have even done that. These people are the, as I've told you before, the political equivalent of ostriches. They keep their head in the sand, and occasionally they raise it up and sniff the wind to see which way the political wind is blowing, and then that's what they do. They don't really have a core set of principles other than their electability, and he looked at the lay of the land now, and in a state that Trump won by 42 points, he thought it was time to get on the Trump train, and that's what he did.
Yes. Well, Catherine, Tim mentioned Bill Clinton. And, of course, when Bill Clinton won office, there was a
no,
I think
no,
he
no.
Was
Hillary
talking
Clinton.
About party. He was
Hillary
talking about
Clinton.
Hillary.
Hillary
Clinton.
Oh, I thought you meant
Hillary
it.
Clinton.
I thought you meant, well, I'm gonna frame it. Okay, you mentioned Clinton, and I'm going to go back to Bill. When Bill Clinton won the presidency, there was a slew of party switchers, particularly in the South. President Obama won. There was more party switchers in different places. So you're like, okay, we have the national office, and then people at the local level run away from us. Now they get in charge, and can't get any more unpopular, and still we lose people. Why in the world do we have more people seemingly switch from our side to their side than the other way around?
I don't think he switched from one side to the other. He was always a Republican. He just ran because it was as a Democrat to be for his convenience. I don't think we lost anything. We didn't lose him. We never had him.
Well, when he's on C-SPAN or the governor's conference, and they, you know, inside the parentheses bracket, they throw a D under his name. That's what I mean.
Yeah, but
I don't mean that he's shedding tears.
But that doesn't matter if he's not, you know, pushing Democratic principles and he's not acting like a Democrat. Then what the hell difference does it make? I mean, I guess it makes a difference. You know, I know you guys think of it as in numbers, but I think of it as, you know, delivering, policy and legislation that, you know, helps people, that, you know, reflects Democratic values. He wasn't going to do that anyway. So, I mean, I just don't see it the same way. I just don't see it the same way.
Minority,
we didn't have him anyway.
David Clark, he mentioned on his Twitter feed that with that switch, they now control tying 1922 a record number of governorships in the country. Now, of course, at that time we had 48 states, so they now control 67% of the gubernatorial rate offices instead of 71, I think it was at that time. And those kind of things come out, and it just sometimes, unfortunately, I think there are some swingish type voters. They want to be with a winner, same kind of people that's how they pick out television shows and music and sports teams. They want to be with a winner. And this kind of thing doesn't help that. I know that may not be very core. It may not be very authentic, but it's not a good look. It's something you don't want to have to explain. Catherine?
I don't disagree with you that I'm not saying that it's good, but I don't think we had him anyway. Like I get that, you know, we've lost a D in the governors of the United States, but I don't think he was going to deliver Democratic values to the citizens of West Virginia. So, I mean, I understand what you're saying, and I don't disagree with you that, you know, people like to vote for a winner, and we want to dominate the best we can. I don't disagree with that, but for me, it's like, well, we didn't really have them anyway. It's like these, the Blue Dog Democrats. They're not really Democrats. They're Republicans with Democratic coats on. I'm not saying it's not good to have them.
A lot of places, some of those folks, you know, if they truly were Republicans, they would have been Republicans from the get-go. I mean, some of the folks that stayed with the Democratic Party throughout and, you know, just lost in the recent elections, Mike McIntyre, I think he was one of his folks was on our show a few weeks ago from Emory. John Barrow, they might have been a little more conservative, but they stayed with the Democratic Party when the Democratic Party brand in their area was not just the one you choose for political expediency. So I wouldn't paint all Blue Dog Democrats with the same brush.
Okay, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, there are a lot of places where if you just want to win, you're going to have an easier time as a Republican. But if you stay with Democrats, there's some tie there on some policy issues. Well, great show tonight. We had a good discussion. Jackson Darr was great, as always. And next week, we'll be back with the Cuzzy Vine.
Good night, guys.
Night, everybody.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs.